Our speaker tonight has produced a new examination of the monumental 1937 struggle between FDR and the Supreme Court, just as the most recent presidential challenge to the court is fresh in our minds. Jeff Schessel, I've discovered, is a bit of a Renaissance man. He is a Rhodes Scholar who graduated from Brown in 1991, and he received a Master's in History from Oxford in 1993. For many years, he wrote and drew the syndicated comic strip Thatch that appeared in more than 150 newspapers nationwide. In 1997, Jeff published his first full-length historical work, Mutual Contempt, Lyndon Johnson, Robert Kennedy, and the Feud That Defined a Decade. President Bill Clinton was so impressed with Mutual Contempt that later that year, the president invited Jeff to join the White House speechwriting team. And during his 3 years at the White House, Jeff rose to become Deputy Chief of Presidential Speechwriting, was a member of the White House senior staff, and took the lead in drafting the State of the Union Address, President Clinton's 2000 convention speech, and the Farewell Address. His experience in the comics business also served him well as lead of the president's team of humor writers, the team that produced the hilarious video The Final Days that documented Clinton's wanderings through a deserted White House at the end of his administration, doing laundry, washing the limousine, playing battleship with the Joint Chiefs in the Situation Room, and robbing the vending machines. It was premiered at the 2000 White House Correspondents' Dinner, and you can still see it today on YouTube. Since leaving the White House, Jeff co-founded and is an active partner in West Wing Writers, a strategic communications firm. Fortunately for all of us, though, his work at West Wing Writers has not deterred him from continuing his work in the history field. I first met Jeff when he made his initial research visit to the library in April 2006, and it is always a pleasure, as an archivist, to see the final fruit of our researchers' hard work. So I'm very happy to introduce to you tonight Mr. Jeff Schessel.
Thanks very much. I'm going to go with clairvoyance. I had it all sorted out in advance. Well, thanks for coming out tonight, and I want to extend a special thank you to Bob Clark for your hospitality tonight, but more significantly for the help and hospitality you showed me when I came in 2006, and I've bothered Bob many times since with questions large and small, and always got an immediate answer and a correct answer, and that research, the fruits of that research are seen throughout this book, and I'm grateful to you, and thanks for having me back. I'm honored to be here in Hyde Park. Talking about Roosevelt in Hyde Park is a little bit daunting. Here on what many Americans would consider to be hallowed ground. And I'm here to talk about Franklin Roosevelt and the conflict that in the years before World War II really defined his presidency. As Bob mentioned, I, of course, did much of my research here at the library, and as a former presidential speechwriter, I took a special pleasure in going through the speech files and getting to hold in my hands the drafts that President Roosevelt worked on and marked up in the margins with his very recognizable, after a while, slanted handwriting. You find it in the margins and between the lines of a draft. You see what a careful editor he was, how thoughtful he was about what he wanted to say and what he wanted to convey. And these pencil marks, you look at them, and it's very hard to imagine that some of these are three-quarters of a century old. There's a metaphor in that, I think. Speechwriters have a weakness for metaphors, so please indulge me. 65 years after Franklin Roosevelt's death, he still does not quite feel like history. Now, some presidential libraries, and I'm not saying which ones, do their best to rekindle interest in people and events who no longer feel relevant to our national life. They feel very remote from the lives that we now lead. And there's a sense at those libraries of fragility, of imminent loss, that people are just about to forget things and people that were very important at one time. That's not the case around here for the reasons that Bob mentioned. We really are all still living in the house that Roosevelt built, the reality that he defined for our nation and our world. That legacy is still very much alive. It's still strong, and at the same time, it's still under siege by the same forces that predicted that the New Deal would lead us down what Herbert Hoover called the suicide road toward dictatorship and socialism. communism and all the rest. We can all imagine what Franklin Roosevelt's reaction would be to the attacks on Barack Obama as a socialist. Barack, he might say, I feel your pain. Or I may be channeling the wrong past president. The fact that the Roosevelt legacy is so fiercely contested today is a sign of just how alive that legacy is. FDR, in my view, is rarely seen more relevant than he does right now. We live, of course, in a time of economic crisis. We have a progressive president who, at least for now, has large majorities in both houses of Congress. And we have an energized, determined conservative opposition in the grassroots, in the Congress, and in the United States Supreme Court. Now, I'm not clairvoyant. I didn't write this book with the present situation in mind. I actually finished writing right around the time that Barack Obama was inaugurated. But I did write in full awareness that the battlefield of what became known as FDR's court fight is still and is always contested ground. The questions at the heart of Roosevelt's struggle with the Supreme Court are always open questions in our democracy. Open questions of the meaning of the Constitution, the limits of presidential and governmental power, and whether democracy can be made to work in times of crisis. History may not repeat itself exactly, but it certainly does echo itself, sometimes very loudly. And now, I think, is one of those times. You really do have to go all the way back to 1937, Reagan's comment in 88 notwithstanding, to find a president remarking so directly about the Supreme Court in the State of the Union address. You have to go back to 1937 to find a Chief Justice, Charles Evans Hughes, who fired back publicly, as I'll describe in a minute. So today, I think, is a very good time to reckon with what happened in 1937, with why it happened, and what the consequences were. And that's what I'd like to address in my remarks tonight, and then I'll be eager to take your questions if you have any. I was drawn to the story of the court packing fight for a few reasons. First, it's the greatest constitutional crisis of the past century. Second, it's the most overlooked defining event of Franklin Roosevelt's presidency. And thirdly, it's a pivot point in American history. It's really the moment when the court and therefore the country really totally enter the 20th century. But despite its significance, the court fight is one of those historical events that gets mentioned a lot, but very rarely explained fully. It tends to get reduced to a neat little parable of presidential overreach, second-term overreach. It gets reduced to a single word, hubris. Now, I knew that hubris had something to do with this story, but it never seemed to me to be a sufficient explanation for what Roosevelt did in this moment. I never really understood or accepted the narrative that we have Roosevelt that we all know and most of us like right up until 1937. Suddenly he loses his head and does something crazy like propose to pack the court, and then he's back to being the happy Roosevelt that we all know and most of us like. The question at the core of this book is what leads Roosevelt, who was described at the time as the greatest politician ever to be placed within a human skin, as one magazine put it, what drove him to do something as seemingly radical and self-destructive as trying to expand the Supreme Court by six and to fill all those seats with liberal justices? Is it enough to say that he was feeling arrogant after his 1936 landslide reelection? I didn't think so, but the mystery that leaves is what drew me in. What drove FDR to make the biggest political miscalculation and mistake of his entire life? There are other mysteries at the heart of this story as well. Namely, what led the Supreme Court to change course in the middle of this fight, dramatically and decisively, in the middle of this fight, start upholding the New Deal after 2 years of striking it down? And what led the Congress to reject the court packing plan and defy the president after 4 years in which the Congress had essentially done anything, just about anything, that President Roosevelt had asked it to do? And there's one more reason that I was drawn to this subject, and that's because it's a remarkable drama with compelling characters, with elements of tragedy and comedy, and with unexpected twists and turns that really do change the outcome. The fall of Roosevelt in this moment, before his subsequent revival, is, take your pick, either Shakespearean or Greek. Just think about this. In January 1937, Roosevelt was at the peak of his power. As he began his second term, the nation was closer to one-party rule than it had been since Reconstruction. There were 96 senators at the time, and 76 of them were Democrats in January 1937, and not all of the remaining 20 were Republicans. In February, a month later, when Roosevelt launched his plan, he seemed almost certain to prevail. The general assumption was, of course, he'll get exactly what he wants. And one senator declared at the time, "Why, if the president asked Congress to commit suicide tomorrow, they'd do it." And 6 months later, only 6 months, 168 days later to be exact, the court bill was dead. The Supreme Court had reversed course, ushering in what's been called the Constitutional Revolution of 1937, and the next phase of the New Deal was stalled, and a new and powerful conservative coalition had emerged and would only grow in strength over the succeeding decades. This may be a clash of institutions and a battle of ideas, but it's also a very human drama. The combatants on both sides believed that they were fighting for the survival of democracy, but they were also driven, as is always the case in political life, by arrogance, ambition, vanity, resentment, fear, and rage. Sound familiar? And all of these emotions are as important to the outcome of this story as, say, something like the doctrine of substantive due process or the Commerce Clause. So what happened? Well, the court fight was something that Roosevelt and his advisors had seen coming from the very beginning. And they weren't the only ones. It was anticipated in the press. The court in 1933, when Franklin Roosevelt took the oath of office in March, was the oldest Supreme Court in history. The average age of the justices was 71. Today it's 68. It's not that much younger. But more significant than the age, these were in spirit and in ideology, many of them were 19th century men. The irony of all this is that the oldest justice, Louis Brandeis, was the leading liberal light of the court. So age did not necessarily define one's outlook, as is always the case. Age doesn't necessarily define outlook, but some of the other older justices were really very anchored in an America that no longer existed. One of the conservatives, Willis Vandevanter, was old enough to remember as a young boy watching the funeral procession of Abraham Lincoln. And Sutherland, George Sutherland, another conservative, was born in England, and he was born before either Gladstone or Disraeli had served as prime minister. Charles Evans Hughes, when he was a student at Brown University, had no running water in his dorm, had no central electricity, and had two closets. He had one for his stuff and the other for coal, which he would use to shovel into his coal-burning stove to keep himself warm. So these men grew up in a very different era than Franklin Roosevelt, and many of them were wedded to a very different set of ideas than Franklin Roosevelt. Their notions of constitutionality went way back and were tied to not only the legal doctrines of the Gilded Era, you know, laissez-faire America, but also of very old notions of small government and limited presidential powers and states' rights and so forth. Now, this was a court, ironically, led by a man who had been a reformer early in his career, Charles Evans Hughes. As many of you know, he was governor of this state. He had actually become governor because he had been a crusader and had taken on the gas and insurance industries and swept into Albany with a bright red beard and was seen as something of a radical and a real reformer. He wound up on the Supreme Court in 1910, and he aligned himself with Brandeis and with Holmes and the liberals and joined them very often in dissent and sometimes in the majority. And he left that court, as many of you I'm sure know, in 1916 to run against President Wilson on the Republican ticket and very nearly won that year. By 1930, when he was appointed Chief Justice by Hoover, he had spent a number of years as Secretary of State in the Harding administration and then as probably the greatest corporate lawyer in America. Hughes was such an imposing presence that just about everybody who spent any time near him compared him to God himself. He had this great Van Dyke beard, would sort of look down on anybody, literally, who was speaking to him, and was often compared to, take your pick, Jove, Zeus, or the Lord God. He very much had that presence in the courtroom, even as a lawyer, even before he put on the robe of Chief Justice. Benjamin Cardozo, who was on the Court of Appeals here in New York before he wound up on the U.S. Supreme Court, said that when he had a rule, Cardozo did, that any time that Hughes came to argue a case before him, Cardozo refused to reach a decision in the case for at least 24 hours because he thought he needed at least that much time to clear his head of the spell that Hughes had cast upon him. Only then could he make a rational decision about the case. So he was in many ways the greatest lawyer in America and had a record both as a liberal and a conservative. But shortly after he went back on the court in 1930, it seemed that he had thrown his lot in with the conservatives. And the long march of very conservative and reactionary decisions that began in the 1880s and picked up in earnest not long after that seemed sure to continue as Roosevelt got into office. Roosevelt had a very different understanding of the Constitution that aligned more with the way Woodrow Wilson and a number of others thought about it. He thought of it as an organic thing, as a living thing. That was the language that he used. He once said that the Constitution was a marvelously elastic compilation of rules, which is maybe not a piece of poetry, but it does give you a sense of what Roosevelt thought of the Constitution. He often quoted a former Chief Justice who said that the Constitution was a broad avenue through which progress could be enjoyed. Franklin Roosevelt didn't see any conflict at all inherently between the Constitution and the New Deal, but he understood that the justices on the Supreme Court were likely to see it differently. And so even before he's inaugurated as president in 1933, he and his team are already talking about what to do about these conservative justices on the Supreme Court. And one of Roosevelt's supporters, Senator-elect McAdoo, William McAdoo, who was coming in 1933, took Homer Cummings aside. Homer Cummings was Roosevelt's incoming attorney general, and said, "What are we going to do," in his words, "about the old fossils on the Supreme Court?" And McAdoo had an idea. He wanted to pass a law or a constitutional amendment that would say that once you reach the age of 72, you are relegated as a justice to emeritus status. You get to stay technically on the court, but you don't get to decide anything. And so this is not what we would call grappling with the issue, but there was certainly some talk about the issue and some talk in the press about it. So this is beginning even before Roosevelt is president, and really, as you might imagine, picks up in great earnest in the beginning of 1935 when the court begins to strike down the New Deal, essentially overruling the New Deal, not just program by program, but ruling that the very premises of the New Deal, the idea that the government has an obligation to provide economic security to its citizens, ruling that that notion is abhorrent to the Constitution and not consistent with it. So they begin in January 1935 to strike down the New Deal. First, they strike down a piece of the NRA, the Recovery Act, the National Recovery Administration. And the conservative press cheers. One newspaper says, finally, the court has begun to, quote, throw this revolutionary nonsense into the Potomac where it belongs. And a few months later, on a day that was known at the time as Black Monday in May 1935, the court struck down the entirety of the NRA. And this actually was not a split decision as so many of them that followed. This was a 9-0 decision. The justices ruled that the Roosevelt administration had gone much too far in delegating the power of the Congress to non-governmental entities, these code authorities that were reaching agreements industry by industry for minimum wages, maximum hours, and working conditions, and so forth. As the justices are reading this decision, a man in the courtroom in the Supreme Court shouts out, "The revolution is over." And in many ways, it seems that this is true. And after the decisions are read, Justice Brandeis, who was a friend of the administration and in many ways a friend of the New Deal, but also an opponent of the centralization of power, he summons Tommy Corcoran and Ben Cohen, who, as you may know, were two important, emerging as two very important advisors to President Roosevelt. He summons the two of them, who are his protégés, back to the robing room. And as he raises his hands, Corcoran later said he looked like an avenging angel of death. He raises his hands to have the robe removed. He says, "You tell your president that he's been living in a fool's paradise. You tell him that everything that you've been doing will have to be changed. You go back and tell the president we are not going to let this government centralize everything. It's come to an end." And so they went back and communicated this to Roosevelt. And a couple of days later, he held a press conference in which he said that the court in that decision, the Schechter decision, the sick chicken case that some of you might be familiar with, had relegated the United States to what Roosevelt called the horse and buggy definition of interstate commerce. This was an explosive little quote. He held a press conference for an hour and a half, and that was the only thing that he let the reporters quote. That was the practice then, is he could tell them, this is on the record, this is off the record. He allowed that to be on the record, and wound up on the front pages of the papers the next day. It was seen as a slur on old people, and it hurt Roosevelt politically. And he recognized in that moment that this struggle with the court was going to be tougher politically than he realized. This begins a long march over the course of the next year, in which the court struck down a whole series of programs. The big one really was the AAA, the Agricultural Adjustment Act. This goes down in a divided court in January 1936. And over the course of the next 6 months before the end of the term in June 1936, the court strikes down a series of programs. Roosevelt, in his frustration, calls another press conference in June. At the end of the term, he's aghast, as are most Americans at that point, at a decision by the court not to strike down a piece of the New Deal, not to strike down a big federal program, but to strike down New York State's attempt to provide a minimum wage for women. This was a decision, this was a law that had been very carefully crafted by Felix Frankfurter and Ben Cohen to find its way around an earlier Supreme Court decision. And yet the court said, this cannot stand. Roosevelt said, the court is creating a no man's land in which no one can govern, federal or state. And it seemed that way not only to Roosevelt and his supporters, but even to many Republicans. And it threw the Republican Party into some disarray because they had been talking for years by this point about states' rights, that the federal government shouldn't be doing these things. Let's let the states experiment. And now the court was saying states can't do it either. And so even the Republicans at their 1936 convention felt that they might need to push for a constitutional amendment to allow states to create minimum wages. So over the course of this remarkable period, the court had constricted the powers of the presidency, of the Congress, and the states. They had covered the constitutional landscape in terms of where they anchored these decisions on grounds of due process, the Commerce Clause, and they revived long dormant doctrines, some of which hadn't been invoked by the court in 30, 40 years and had been discredited, not just abandoned, but discredited. And Stone, Justice Stone, who had been appointed by Coolidge and was a Republican, a friend of Hoover's and so forth, he was no friend of the New Deal, but he had joined with the court's liberals in his belief that the Congress should be free to make whatever mistakes it wanted to make in economic policy. And he said that this court is inventing new doctrine faster than we can possibly absorb it. He felt that this was a remarkable example of judicial overreach, and that it endangered not only the court's reputation, but the country as well. I should point out that this assault was not limited to the Supreme Court alone. It was across the entire federal judiciary. In 1935 alone, district court judges issued more than 1,600 injunctions halting enforcement of New Deal laws. So the New Deal was being systematically stopped across the country. So at the end of this term, Ray Clapper, a columnist, likened the whole thing to a Shakespeare drama in which at the end of the play, the stage is strewn with dead bodies. The dead bodies were New Deal programs. And FDR said that the course of destruction, in his words, had led to a complete breakdown of the system of government. A little bit of an overstatement, but these were the stakes as people saw them. And Roosevelt firmly believed, and many people in this country believed, that if something couldn't be done about the Supreme Court, if something couldn't be done to get the court to recognize workers' right to organize, workers' rights to collectively bargain, couldn't recognize if the court wouldn't uphold some system of minimum wages, some system of maximum hours, that there would be a total economic collapse in the country. And there would be violent disorder, and ultimately, from the ashes, a dictator would emerge. And so Roosevelt, throughout this period, weighed his options very carefully. But he was quite clear in his mind that something would have to be done about the Supreme Court. He considered a countless number of different constitutional amendments. There were a lot of these amendments in the air. In 1936, there were more than 100 proposals floating around the Congress for constitutional amendments to either limit the powers of the Supreme Court or aggrandize the powers of the Congress so that the Congress could simply overturn any decision of the Supreme Court, so that the court would no longer be the last word on matters of constitutional law. Some of these were really strikingly radical, but they were discussed widely in the press and considered by many serious-minded Americans that perhaps now is the time that we would have to take economic questions out of the hands of the Supreme Court. If it was a piece of economic legislation, the court couldn't review it. And some actually thought that the court should no longer be able to review acts of Congress at all. That if Congress passes it, that's it. These were radical proposals. And Roosevelt and his Justice Department carefully considered all of them and their implications. For 2 years, massive memos, 65-page memos by brilliant lawyers who went on to very storied careers on the federal bench, studied these questions. And ultimately, where Roosevelt wound up after this whole period was essentially where he began. He did not believe, as I said earlier, that there was any contradiction between the New Deal and the Constitution. The problem, as he saw it, were these five conservative justices in the majority on the Supreme Court. And so, as he continued to study the question, his focus more and more turn to these particular justices, how to get them off the court, if possible. Maybe they could impose an age limit. Maybe they could impose a term limit. They considered all of these things. But the life tenure of the Supreme Court justices is established in the Constitution, and so if you want to end that, you've got to pass a constitutional amendment. And as I said, Roosevelt didn't think there was anything wrong with the Constitution, and he also thought that trying to pass an amendment, he wasn't averse to that kind of amendment, but he didn't think it was going to be very easy to do. It wasn't going to solve the problem quickly enough. He really felt that violence and disorder were imminent in this country, as I said, if he couldn't solve the problem soon. So he and Homer Cummings turned to the solution that had been in the air all along, but mostly discredited, and that was the idea of packing the Supreme Court. Now, most people then and now weren't and aren't aware that the number 9 does not appear in the United States Constitution. There is nothing in the Constitution that says how many justices there have to be in the Supreme Court. That is up to Congress. And in 1789, Congress set the number at 6. They then dropped it to 5. They shot it up to 7. And over the course of the 19th century, it went up and down repeatedly, reaching as high as 10 under Lincoln. And usually this was done for political reasons. A whole series of presidents came before Congress. Madison, Monroe, John Quincy Adams, Jackson, they all asked Congress to add some seats to the court so they could influence its decisions by getting to appoint more justices. They were all rejected, although Congress did add a seat on the very last day of Jackson's term. Most remarkably, in the sequence of events, in 1866, Congress actually eliminated two seats from the Supreme Court. Somebody retired, Congress immediately eliminated the seat and said, we're eliminating the next one as soon as somebody else retires, just so that Andrew Johnson would not get a chance to appoint anybody. So the number of justices was a political football through the 19th century, and this was all perfectly constitutional. But it settled at 9 under Grant in 1869, and it had been there ever since. And so there were a few Americans in 1937 who actually knew the number had ever been anything other than 9. It had felt that it seemed to be ordained, as most things seem to be, by the Constitution. So the idea of changing it seemed very radical indeed. But Roosevelt came to believe that this was the ideal solution. It was constitutional. It was quick. If Congress could pass a court packing bill quickly, it would be effective overnight. If he could find the right numbers, he could outnumber the conservatives on the court with liberals. And it was a clever decision, and he had a weakness for cleverness. We'll talk about it in a minute. He did not feel that he could wait any longer. As I said at the beginning, this was the oldest court in history, and so you would imagine that if you just waited that somebody would retire or maybe pass away. But he felt that the situation was so urgent that he couldn't wait, and he also heard the rumors that that the conservatives had no interest in retiring. James McReynolds, who was the most extreme of all these conservatives, actually said, and it was widely reported, whispered around Washington anyway, I'll never resign from the bench as long as that crippled SOB is still in the White House. So Roosevelt didn't think they were going anywhere. And by the time he was reelected, he felt that he had to act now, and he felt, as many reporters said at the time, that he had the whip hand, as they put it, that he had been reelected by such a massive margin that he could do essentially what he wanted to do. And so he and Cummings, after 4 years in which they had cast a very wide net, talked to all sorts of people, engaged in all sorts of discussions, they essentially shut down the process and went into a two-man huddle where they kept their plans secret even from other members of the inner circle and from other members of the Justice Department. And they came up with the idea, really a brilliant stroke at the last minute, that the peg that they would hang this on was age. Again, they went back to the beginning. And rather than simply say, we're going to add justices to the court, they came up with a device that said, for every justice older than 70 who is unwilling to retire, we get to add a justice to essentially sit beside the old guy and do the work. And so this would have given Roosevelt 6 new appointments immediately, assuming that nobody retired. And if they retired, great. That was the whole aim, was to get them to go. And so he crafted this plan in secret, and on February 5th, he summoned his cabinet, and he summoned members of Congress, and a half an hour before going and giving a press conference and telling the world about his plans, he let the Congress and the cabinet know what he was up to. The reaction in this small group was a sign of the reaction that he was going to get broadly. They were horrified. They were horrified, many of them, by the notion of packing the court, and they were also horrified, as were Roosevelt's advisors, by the clever packaging that wasn't actually so clever at all. Roosevelt, rather than admitting what everybody really knew, which is that this was about the ideology of the justices, he wrapped it up in notions of efficiency and said, in an impolitic way, you know, old people, they slow down and they're not so efficient, and these justices need some help. They're behind in their work, which was patently untrue, and the Department of Justice's own numbers pointed this out. It was very easy to destroy this notion, and it's hard to believe that Cummings and Roosevelt were so seduced by their own thinking on this, but because they stopped checking with other members of the circle until it was too late, they really convinced themselves that this would get it through. And so there was an excess, as I said earlier, of cleverness, and also, in a weird way, of cautiousness. Roosevelt wasn't so sure after the events of 35 and 36 that the public would stay with him in an all-out assault on the ideology of the Supreme Court. And so he thought by couching it in concerns about efficiency and saying, this isn't just about the Supreme Court, by the way, this is about the entire federal judiciary. We need to add judges at every level. That he would somehow find his way through, that he would somehow thread this needle. It was very clear immediately that that was not the case. And as Hatton Sumners, who was the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, as he was leaving the White House, having just been told about the plan by Roosevelt, he turned to his fellow members of Congress and said, boys, here's where I cash in my chips. He was no longer with the president. Now, Vice President Garner, who had known nothing about any of this, followed them to the Senate, and as the bill, the court-packing bill, was read aloud in the Senate, Garner stood in a very public place in the well of the Senate, held his nose, and gestured thumbs down. And this was a signal to rebellion. And it was widely reported and quite remarkable. The press, which had been so strongly against Roosevelt in 1936 and had felt very defeated by the results of that election, exploded in righteous indignation. And as the New Yorker magazine put it, one right-wing New York newspaper, quote, just took off all its clothes and stood screaming in the middle of the marketplace. It was a firestorm. And while the public maybe remarkably was evenly split about the plan, the poll numbers stayed pretty close throughout this six-month fight. The opponents certainly had an emotional edge, and you saw erupt in the country town hall meetings, arguments on street corners and at bars. There's a story in the New Yorker that between calls, telephone operators would argue with one another about it. This was the only topic of conversation for a long period of time. And Roosevelt found very quickly that his coalition that he had built, which had been so massive and so dominant in 1936, had begun to splinter. And progressive Democrats, many of whom had grievances with Roosevelt, began to leave him immediately. Conservative Democrats, who had gone along dutifully with the New Deal, even though they didn't believe in it, they began to leave immediately. What they saw in the court packing plan was a liberal Supreme Court that would desegregate the South. They saw it right away, and they were quite open with one another and ultimately with the public about it. They saw it coming, and they were not wrong, because when we finally did have a liberal Supreme Court, it took another 20 years, or a little less than 20 years. But as we know, that's exactly what a liberal court did. Conservative Republicans were shrewd enough to stay quiet through all this and allowed this to be a family fight among Democrats, a very effective strategy. Even more effective was the actions were the actions of Charles Evans Hughes. The justices were really itching, a number of them, itching to get in this fight, and it was very hard to keep them quiet, and a number of them flirted with the idea of actually testifying against the plan in the Senate when the Senate began to debate the bill. And incredibly, really, when you think about it, if you imagine this in the present context, Chief Justice Hughes let the word go forth that he was actually willing to sit in the Senate and testify against it. Stone considered doing it, too. Ultimately, Brandeis convinced Hughes not to do that. He thought it would bring discredit upon the court to get into a political controversy. But the two of them, who both opposed the plan, they all did. Some of them even thought about resigning in protest, though none did. They cooked up an idea that they would write an open letter to the leader of the Senate opposition, a Democrat named Burt Wheeler, and would take apart the plan piece by piece. This was Brandeis and Hughes' idea, and so Wheeler eagerly took the letter from Hughes and then read it out loud in the Senate to great effect. It had a devastating effect on the plan. And so over the course of this six-month fight, Roosevelt is dealt blow after blow after blow. The most significant one is, as I mentioned before, that the Supreme Court switched. It's generally known as the switch in time that saved nine. There were a couple of decisions in which the court reversed course. The first, in March 1937, the court upheld a minimum wage law that was essentially identical. It was a Washington state law, essentially identical to the New York law that it had killed only 1 year before. Owen Roberts, the justice in the middle, switched. And then a month later, they upheld the Wagner Act, the National Labor Relations Act, which was a hugely significant decision. Unlike the minimum wage case, this one was about federal power. Not long after that, Justice Van Devanter, one of the conservatives, in a well-timed, deliberate decision, decides to retire, pulling out yet another leg from underneath the plan. And yet Roosevelt feels that he has to continue to fight. This is no longer a fight between himself and the court. This is a fight for the control of Congress. And he has to subdue the rebels in his party, both the progressives and the conservatives. He can't give up now. And so when his aides come before him and they say he should compromise, he rejects all compromises. One of the interesting things that I found is that really, at many points, even after he had suffered all these blows, Roosevelt could have immediately compromised and gotten himself four or maybe just two justices, and we would have a court today of 11 or 13. But he rejected any compromise because he didn't want to be seen as giving in. And he also recognized, with respect to the two-judge compromise, that he couldn't gain by a two-judge compromise because years before, he had openly promised a Supreme Court seat to the Senate Majority Leader, Joe Robinson of Arkansas, who was sort of a bull of a man, and he had carried the New Deal through the Congress on his shoulders, even though he wasn't in favor of it. And Roosevelt knew, and everybody knew, that once Robinson got on the court, he was not going to be a New Deal supporter anymore. So if you filled one seat with Robinson and another seat with a liberal, you had no net gain on the court. So a two-judge compromise did nothing for Roosevelt, and he fought on till the end. And Robinson, in one of the great ironies of this court fight, one of the many ironies of this court fight, Robinson is fighting to create a seat for himself on the Supreme Court, and everybody knows it. And he feels to the last that he might get this through. And so in July 1937, in sweltering Washington heat, he opens the Senate debate, stands in the well of the Senate, shouting, bellowing at people in the galleries, getting into back and forth fights with Wheeler and everybody else on the floor. And in the middle of this, he collapses on the floor. He turns purple and collapses on the floor. He's carried out. They give him some air. They tell him to go home. He spends a little time at home. And the next morning, nobody sees him. And so his aide goes to his apartment, knocks on the door. Nobody answers. He's dead on the floor of his apartment. And with the death of Robinson, dies the court plan. It is possible, maybe even likely, that to that moment, a compromise is possible. Maybe not outright success, but maybe four judges is possible. And with Robinson dies the possibility of packing the court. Now, looking back, in the moment it's always hard to know that history is being made. And at the end of a massive three-branch of government brawl like this, the immediate question has to be who won, who lost, and what next? In the immediate sense, FDR had dealt himself a terrible blow. He had divided his supporters. He had emboldened his enemies. He had stalled the agenda that he was trying to save. For this entire period, nothing else got done. And as his mandate dissolved, his second-term mandate, so did the myth of his omnipotence. The Saturday Evening Post wrote after the fight, "He commands support, but not the old awe, reverence, or idolatry." That much was obvious right away. But only in time did it become clear that some of the damage was permanent. The New Deal really never recovered its momentum. That's yet another of the ironies, and that is that the court packing plan, more than any decision of the Supreme Court, ended reform. Also, the wedge that Roosevelt drove between liberal and conservative Democrats was also permanent. Roosevelt did not create that division. It had always essentially existed, but his court plan widened it, and it drove the conservative Democrats into allegiance with Republicans really actively for the first time. And those who worked together to kill the court bill soon found common cause on any number of things. And ultimately, as we know, over succeeding decades, these conservative Republicans, one after another, conservative Democrats became Republicans. And that really happened finally after Lyndon Johnson passed the Civil Rights Act. But this was really set in motion in a very active way during the court fight. And finally, and most significantly, the switch in time that Save 9 became a permanent shift, as permanent as any shift can be on the Supreme Court. And the certainty of FDR and most liberals that Roberts would switch back turned out to be partly right, but not entirely. But by that point, Roosevelt had had a chance to completely transform the court with his own appointees. By the time that he died, he had appointed 8 of the 9 justices on the court. Giants like Black, Hugo Black, Felix Frankfurter, William Douglas, and Robert Jackson, who proceeded to overrule the most controversial decisions of that period and usher in a new era of constitutional interpretation in which the legislature would have much greater latitude in deciding what was in the economic interest of American citizens. The court had finally reconciled itself with the 20th century. We lost the battle, Roosevelt said, but we won the war. Now, what in the end does this episode tell us about the Supreme Court? One thing above all, the judges are human beings, which probably does not strike us as a surprising notion or a radical notion, but in the 1930s it was really only beginning to dawn on people. In the popular press, the justices were still portrayed as, and this is a quote, black-robed gods who stood far above the political fray. Now, that notion was already under assault before Roosevelt took office, but it was really the court's fight against the New Deal that did serious and permanent damage to the idea of judges as above politics and impartial. These were not only human beings, but these were politically minded and socially aware human beings who were moved, like the rest of us, by feelings of pride and shame and vanity and rage and regret. They were also capable of growth and inconsistency, like the rest of us. Now, what does this tell us about Roosevelt? To go back to something I said at the beginning, it reveals him as very human, too. Not just because this is an act of hubris, because it is certainly more than that. Hubris has something to do with this, absolutely. He was feeling very powerful indeed after the 1936 landslide. But as I said before, he was deeply dedicated to the objectives of the New Deal. He also deeply believed in this notion of the Constitution as a living thing, an interpretation needed to evolve with changing realities. And the court plan was a clumsy attempt to reach those objectives. Finally, what does this tell us, if anything, about our present moment? Let me just close with a few quick observations on that. First, I think there are risks for President Obama in personalizing the conflict with the court. I think, personally, he was right to criticize the decision in Citizens United, which overturns 100 years of law and many decades of precedent. And I think he was right to do it in the State of the Union address. I thought he did it in a very restrained fashion. What I question, and where I see the risk based on Roosevelt's experience, is in an extended back and forth with the justices. The issue, as one magazine put it in 1936, is packed with the most deadly dynamite. It hands a very easy issue to the president's opponents. And so while I think that President Obama should continue to criticize the court when it oversteps its role and when it makes a decision like Citizens United, I think that he needs to hold back his advisors, who seemed all too eager in the past couple of weeks, to engage in a back and forth with the Chief Justice. Now, secondly, I think there are risks for the court as well. Chief Justice Hughes observed that for all the attacks over many decades, really over the centuries, against the Supreme Court, most of the damage that had ever been done to the court was self-inflicted. And I think that Chief Justice Roberts and the other justices might want to take that advice to heart. So much of the court's authority still flows from the sense that the justices are impartial, or at least that they're capable of being impartial. We no longer believe, as many people did in the 1930s, that there's something purifying about putting on the judicial robes. But we do want to believe that judges try harder than members of the other branches to separate themselves from their prejudices and their partisan affiliations. That's much harder for us to believe when the Chief Justice gets into a public sparring match with the other branches of government. Third and finally, the argument that's raging today about the Health Care Act, including the drumbeat of attacks this very day on its constitutionality, is really, as we can see, a very old argument about the role of government. That argument has been raging since the founding of our country, and during times of economic distress, as in the 1930s, as in our own time, it gets explosive, even violent. Franklin Roosevelt understood that the struggle is never settled. It's the same fundamental argument that divided Jefferson and Hamilton, Theodore Roosevelt and Taft, and later Kennedy and Nixon, Clinton and Gingrich, and Obama and today's Republican Party and Tea Party movement. We won the war, Roosevelt said in 1937, but he knew that each successive generation, standing on the foundation he built, would have to wage and win that war for itself. Thank you. Now, I haven't left a lot of time here, but I'm very happy to take some questions if you all have patience for it.
We've got a mic that we can bring to you as well.
Attorney General Homer Cummings is not generally considered one of the top advisors to FDR, and hearing what you said makes me wonder, did Cummings serve as a kind of yes man and a head nodder to Roosevelt's proposing this, or do you think they were equal partners in conceiving of the plan?
Ultimately, that's a very interesting question that's hard to unpack. Who's encouraging who here? But it's interesting to know how Roosevelt described Cummings, and Cummings repeated this proudly around Washington. I like this fellow Homer Cummings, Roosevelt said. He finds a way to say yes. He finds a way to make it legal, to make it constitutional. And that was essentially how Cummings saw his role, not to say no. And so, now, it's not that Cummings didn't have any intellectual integrity. It's not that he simply followed whatever Roosevelt wanted to do in every instance. He argued quite strongly, Cummings did, against the idea of a constitutional amendment when Roosevelt was still thinking maybe it wasn't a bad idea. Cummings wrote a memo in early 1936 saying, the problem is not the Constitution. The problem is the misinterpretation of the Constitution by these guys on the court. But ultimately, Cummings' job was to figure out how to get this done and how to make it work. And that's what he did. Now, others who were really more valued advisors of the president's, people like Felix Frankfurter and increasingly Robert Jackson during this period, took a different view. But Roosevelt essentially shut them out of the process and limited the circle to the one other person who he knew agreed with him on this. And he believed that the two of them could sort this out together.
Owen Roberts changed his vote, and it sounds as if that was the linchpin that sort of changed the attitude of the court. Is there any speculation as to why he did change his mind in the Washington case as opposed to the New York case?
Well, Roberts is a fascinating guy and will always remain something of a mystery, and I did as much work as I could to try to flesh out his personality. Unfortunately, he burned his papers before he died, which is a very unfortunate thing for the sake of history. Roberts is an interesting guy. You know, he was a brilliant guy. He was the son of a hardware merchant in Philadelphia who went to the University of Pennsylvania and was so brilliant there that as soon as he graduated with a law degree, they hired him immediately to start teaching law. He became an incredibly successful advocate in the courtroom, and he was a Republican in a Republican city, Philadelphia, at that time, and he came to the attention of Calvin Coolidge, who appointed him to investigate the Teapot Dome scandals of the Harding administration, so a sensitive job, and he did his job very carefully, and he actually got Albert Fall, the Secretary of Interior, who was the center of that scandal, got him sent to jail. Now, he was even considered at various points a presidential possibility, Roberts was. But there was a lot of mystery at the time about his ideology, and so when he was appointed to the court by Hoover in 1930, both liberals and conservatives cheered because they both thought they had their man on the court. And there was actually, over the next 5 years, a lot of debate within the court about what Owen Roberts really believed. And he was really, I think, ideologically very uncertain. But he got caught up in a reaction in conservative circles against the New Deal. And so not only does he vote against the New Deal in some of those early decisions, but he writes the decisions, and he writes very angry, strident, sweeping decisions, which makes his conversion really remarkable. So what happened? Well, a lot of people in the years since have attributed it, as Roosevelt did, to the court packing plan. But subsequently, it's been revealed that he actually changed his mind and voted to uphold that second minimum wage law. He voted in conference before the court packing plan was launched. That wasn't made public. They held back the decision. They were waiting for Justice Stone, who was sick, to come back to the court so they could have all nine votes. But he had changed his mind. Still the question, why? He was very active in political life and in Washington life, and he seems to have suffered a lot more than any of the other justices when the court had come under attack. Because just as Justice Kennedy takes most of the heat right now because he's the swing vote, nobody gives Scalia a lot of heat. We know where Scalia is going to go. The question is Kennedy going to go along with him? And so when he does, liberals really attack Kennedy. And it was true at that moment as well. And so when the court overruled the minimum wage law in 1936, the attacks mostly focused on Roberts. And they were fierce, very personal attacks. They called him a dictator and all kinds of things. And then shortly after that, Roosevelt was reelected by a stunning margin that a lot of people, most people, hadn't seen coming. And so it seems clear in retrospect, given some things that Robert said later in life, that he was reacting to the political atmosphere in the country and how it had changed. Not to the court packing plan itself, but to the change in the environment.
Who do you think is going to resign from the Supreme Court first? Is it Justice Stevens, who's the oldest, or Justice Ginsburg, who's probably the sickest, or both?
Well, I can't claim any great insight, but as you may have seen in Jeffrey Toobin's piece in The New Yorker, Justice Stevens has said that it'll happen within the next 3 years. I'm not sure. That may be a little bit of a head fake, and it may come sooner than that. I think it's clear that both of them will retire before President Obama finishes this term, in case he doesn't get another term. But, you know, I think what's interesting about the court right now is, among many things, is, and this I get from some former clerks and others that I've talked to, is that as soon as President Obama was elected, the tenor in the court changed almost overnight. That some of these conservative justices, including the Chief Justice, who are young and really believe that they were playing a long game, suddenly started grabbing for big constitutional issues that seemed essentially out of reach in given cases, as we saw with the re-argument that they invited on Citizens United. They didn't have to do that. They didn't have to decide these big questions. But they were eager to do it. And I think the sense among the conservatives on the court is that they might all outlast a single term of President Obama, but they're not all going to outlast a second term. And Scalia's not a young guy. He's not really in great shape. And Justice Kennedy is probably in good shape, but also not a young guy. And so there is a sense of urgency I've been hearing among the conservative justices, and you can see it in the decisions.
Sir, would you pass that hand, please?
Thank you very much. What kind of a policy would you suggest the administration take in dealing with this anti-stare decisis court that claims that it was for stare decisis, and that is, the court now has six Catholics on it, of whom four are radical right? How to approach that?
I think on the latter, you don't approach that at all. I think I talk about deadly dynamite. I wouldn't go there. But I do think that the president has an opportunity, and I think a responsibility, to educate the public about what the court is doing, about the role of the court, and the implications of these decisions. Felix Frankfurter, in the middle of the court fight, said to President Roosevelt, "You should take the country to school." And the one thing that Frankfurter liked about the court plan, he didn't like the court plan, he didn't like the idea about packing the court, but he was eager for this opportunity to have a national discussion about the role of the court and the ideology and the jurisprudence of the members of that court. And I think there's a way to do that carefully but consistently without seeming to be getting personal about it. I think what concerned me about the back and forth a couple of weeks ago was not what President Obama said, as I indicated before. It was what the press secretary said on a couple of occasions that same week, and the eagerness to engage with the Chief Justice in the way that they might engage with John Boehner or Mitch McConnell. It's not the same kind of conflict. And the Chief Justice holds a lot more power, both in terms of his official responsibilities and also politically, than Mitch McConnell does. And this is a very dangerous business to get into that kind of argument. But I do think that the president needs to be consistently educating the public about the role of the court. And I think that something like a nomination fight, which is coming if either or both of these justices retire, is an opportunity to have a national discussion about what a Supreme Court justice ought to be like. And it shouldn't be just the sort of typical argument that we have about litmus tests and that sort of nonsense, I would hope.
All right. Well, Jeff will now be available to sign books that you're all going to buy at the media store at a time. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you. Thanks very much.